Kids okay. don't like move kids out of there.
Okay. So last time we finished off right here at the Amorite. Just to review, the Tanaim are the ones who that's the time period of the Mishnah, right? I wrote this down. The Mishnah, and this is the Gemara. Right, so the Tanaim or the Mishnah, which is compiled around 200 CE. This is the first time that they actually wrote down the oral law, the oral tradition, and that's when it was put together here, 200. Remember, we said the Mishnah was very concisely written, dealt predominantly with Jewish law, a little bit outside of Jewish law, but not much on it. And it's the purpose of the Mishnah was to retain the essence and the main laws to know, but at the same time, not to lose the flavor of the way the oral tradition works. Namely, it's still required to teach it. It was just too terse, too concise, that it was hard to really understand with any context unless you had a teacher. The Gemara was written down about 350 years after that, and that first of all gives us the background to the Mishnah, analyzes what the Mishnah is, why it is, the verses in the Torah that the laws are based on. It also delves into a range of other topics that have nothing to do with the Mishnah: history, philosophy, ethics, medical advice, stories and lessons we can learn from the rabbis, the Tanaim, and the Amoraim, and that's all together. It's all compiled in the Gemara. So the Talmud is the two of these intertwined, right? The Mishnah and the Gemara together is the Talmud. Okay. Any questions on that before we go on? Is that pretty clear? Okay. Well, now we're going to cut this off, because when it comes to Jewish law very much works on precedents. And the farther you go back historically, the more legitimacy that perspective has. And so there's certain cutoff points in Jewish history where the next generation can no longer question the validity of the previous generation's conclusions. So if the Gemara gives a final answer that this is the law, which it does plenty of times, later generations do not have any right to question that conclusion. Okay? They might try to understand it within a context, they might try to see when it applies, but they cannot question the validity of the conclusion itself. Okay? So look at it as constitutional law, right? Later Supreme Courts cannot overturn freedom of the press. They can understand it, they can limit it, they can put it into a context, but they can never actually erase freedom of the press from the Constitution. So to the Gaonim and the Rishonim and the Achronim, the later generations cannot change anything that the Gemara actually concludes. Okay? And so to the Gemara can't do that to the Mishnah. If there's a clear conclusion in the Mishnah, a clear law in the Mishnah, the Gemara can't change that. There's all sorts of mechanisms that the Gemara uses at times to qualify and put into context statements made in the Mishnah. It does it all the time. But it can't question the validity itself unless somehow someone in the Gemara can prove that a statement made by someone in the Mishnah was incorrect. They couldn't possibly have said it. I have a different tradition that said something else. So some stuff like that you'll see. But as a general rule, when we go backwards, we're not able to question those previous generations. There's a good story. I told this before from the pulpit, but I like the story. The story of that Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky, who was one of the leading rabbis of the previous generation. I think he died in the About the, probably the mid-90s, early to mid-90s. So he was one of the, you know, European rabbis who came over in the 30s, and he really helped build up American Jewry in many ways. Very special guy, very known for his warmth and known for his insight. So the story goes that he was flying on a plane with two of his adult children. And his two adult children, you know, they weren't sitting together. He was in one aisle, they were in another aisle. So the two adult children keep coming back to him and asking, how's he doing? He's already, you know, a little older, maybe he's in his 60s or 70s. No, not saying anything wrong with that. Not that there's anything wrong with that. I'm just saying, oh gosh, okay. He was in his 80s. I don't know exactly what year. I don't know. So they keep checking on him, seeing how he's doing. And they, you know, so finally the passenger sitting next to him, non-Jewish guy who's about the same age, finally turns to Rabbi Kamen and says, I gotta ask you a question. What is your secret? He says, what do you mean? He said, I gotta be honest, I'm lucky if my kids call me once a month. You know, I'm lucky if the grandkids come and visit every once in a while. My kids can't stand to be around me. And here your kids keep on checking on you and seeing what's going on. Why do they keep doing that? I mean, what's your secret? So he says, the story goes, he says to them, well, there's a major difference in the way my kids see me and your kids see you. He says, how so? He says, your kids see you as one generation closer to being a monkey. My kids see me as one generation being closer to Mount Sinai. That's how you put it. It's an interesting perspective, right? But meaning, you know, something kind of lost today is the concept that previous generations had something that we don't, right? It's even, especially with the rate of technology, the way it moves, you know, the older you are, the more obsolete you are, it seems, in this fast-paced world. And the idea of universal truths and morality, things that the wisdom from a previous generation can have, it's getting lost. But I think in the Jewish world, it really hasn't been lost. I mean, there's still a tremendous amount of reverence for rabbis from previous generations, from rabbis who are, you know, who are older and they grew up in a previous generation. So that's still been retained, and that really comes from this concept that you show tremendous, not just respect, but there's like a line that's not crossed. From this point to this point, that's not crossed. So that's where we left off last time. So the next generations are all going to be working with the assumptions that were established at this time and place. Okay. Question before we go on? Okay. The Gaonic period is a very interesting period in Jewish history. There are a lot of writings going on at that time, although we assume a lot was lost. We didn't have an established center like we did, especially during times in the Amorim. The center of Jewish life is still in Babylonia, and in that surrounding region, Iraq, Iran, Syria, that's still kind of the cradle of Jewish life, but it's beginning to change. There's already Jews. There's Jews in Egypt for sure. There's Jews starting to move into Europe. There's already a lot of Jews in Italy, right? The Italian Jews. That community starts really the destruction of the Second Temple, 70 CE. Romans take tens of thousands of Jewish slaves back to Rome, and that's the beginning of the Jewish community in Rome. which is why that, you know, the Italian Jewish community has a very proud history, and you know, we have an Italian Jew, Daniel Rubin, who's in our community now, and I love asking him about, I'm fascinated by the Italian Jewish community. Just because it predates so many of the later splits that we have had, Ashkenazi and Sfard and Hasidim and all this stuff, they didn't have any of that stuff. I mean, it wasn't completely isolated. I mean, it was interactive with other communities, but Italy, Italian Jewry was one of the most prominent centers of Jewish life for centuries and centuries. And it's really almost lost. It's almost dead today. It's really sad. Yeah.
I was in Florence. I went to see the ghetto over there.
Right.
And there is an Ashkenazi and a Sephardic synagogue next to each other.
That's a modern thing. Yeah, that's modern. That's people moved in from other places, and people have not brought their politics and their Michigas into their life, you know, but for the centuries, they didn't have it. It was its own thing, you know? I mean, look, there was always people moving around, so it wasn't, like, completely isolated. But, anyway, but it had its own traditions, it had its own culture, and it's a fascinating place. So, anyway, that goes back, like I said, that goes back to this period of time. It's some cuisine, right? Right.
Are you telling this Jewish Italian cuisine?
Sure.
I'm sure there is.
Yes. Cucina Ebraica.
Yeah? Yeah?
It's called Cucina Ebraica.
Yeah. No.
But every Jewish community in every country has their own cuisine, doesn't it?
I assume so. I don't know. This is not a cuisine class. That's next semester. We're bringing the...
For Chef Tanya.
Yeah, for Chef Tanya, at least that way.
The Indian was very good last week.
It was.
Okay, good.
I'm impressed.
We'll keep doing. She said it was a tame Indian.
I know. Yeah.
She said she could have made it a lot spicier, but she felt like people wouldn't be ready for it.
She needs to just slowly turn up the.
Yeah, exactly. She said she really kept it on the low. Yeah.
Yeah. No, it was good.
Okay.
Is she coming back?
Is she coming back? Yeah. She's not feeling so well.
No. Person who spoke last week.
Regular?
Oh. Well, she doesn't live here.
Oh.
Yeah.
I didn't like her.
What?
I didn't like her.
Okay, good. Okay. So the Gaon period is a very funny period. It's a real transition period. As the Jewish center is expanding, and Jews are expanding as to where they're living, there's still Jews in Israel, but it's a very small community. Again, Jews are still predominantly in Babylonia, but they're really spreading out. And the writing that's coming out is very eclectic. There's still a number of pretty prominent rabbis of the time, and they all have the name Gaon. Gaon's like great scholar, I guess I would say. Sfardim still use that today very often, right? It's Gaon of Agia. It's Gaon this, right? They'll use that word very, it's almost instead of rabbi, they'll use Gaon very often. And it's a word that's kind of thrown around a lot today. But the Gaonic period was led by these rabbis who were Gaonim. That was their title. So, a few prominent Gaonim. There was Rabbi Shrira Gaon. There was Rabbi Hai Gaon. Probably most famously, Rabbi Saadia Gaon. I don't know how to do this.
Y-A.
Did you just do Y-A?
Yeah.
Saadia, okay, that's good. Saadia Gaon, there's the Bahag, Baal Halacha Gadol. So there's a few, but very often their writings are not read within their actual books. They're quoted by later generations. What's interesting, this is an exception to the rule, in that the Rishonim do not necessarily show the reverence to the Gaonim, that they won't question them. They will. Even though this was seen as two different time periods, the Rishonim have no problem questioning a statement by the Gaonim. They view themselves as equals, really. They'll probably show a little bit more reverence, but not so much, not nearly as much as going back to the Tanaim and the Amoraim. But the Gaonic writing, like I said, was very eclectic. A lot of it was on Jewish law. Rav Saadia Gaon involved himself very much in responding to the Karaites, which were, during that time, had a very strong influence. We talked about the Karaites last week, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So the Karaites, they really start up around 800 CE, around that time period, and they were slowly but steadily gaining a lot of steam and really becoming a very prevalent, very powerful voice in the Jewish community. And they were growing and growing and growing, and Rav Saadia Gaon is the first one who really took them on, especially on the intellectual realm, and he really began to challenge them. So that was something he was known for. Rav Saadia wrote a book on the 613 mitzvahs, and this becomes a big theme throughout both these time periods. The Talmud says that we have Taryag mitzvot, that there's 613 mitzvot, except it doesn't say what the 613 are. So there's many, we'll get to others as well, who did the same thing. Many rabbis, I don't like using the word rabbis, many of the leading Jewish thinkers during this time period who took it upon themselves to enumerate what they thought the sixth engine 13 one. Mitzvah one is this, mitzvah two is this, mitzvah three is that. So Sadik Ohn is one of those, one of the first ones who did that. And others kind of followed suit. It's interesting that's kind of a theme in Jewish writing, is that once somebody compiles a new way of formulating something or structuring something, it then gets copied a lot, or they use that as a template, and then they just add their own opinion and ideas to it. So I think he kind of creates that template, and it's used again over and over again during this time period, and it creates a lot of interesting discussion in Jewish law, and because what's a mitzvah, what's not a mitzvah, what's just a suggestion in the Torah, what's just a good idea. So that becomes something that's talked about a lot. But the Gaonim really don't have many major prominent books that are read widely today, that are used widely today. I think if we looked around this library, I don't think we'd find a single book from this time period, which is interesting in itself. So there's a few.
I think I heard one reason why.
Yeah.
So one of the reasons the Rishonim wrote books is because to explain the Talmud. So people really didn't know what they was talking about. But during the Gaonim period, they did know. There was no reason to write things down so specifically.
Maybe.
That's what I heard.
Well, that's one thing. I mean, another thing is that it's a less educated time period. And the focus of their writing was more explaining the basics to people. So they weren't writing very advanced books, you know. And that's what happens in time periods when Jewish education and Jewish practice is very low. So the books that are coming out might be more basic and might just speak to that generation.
Which period is the basic? More basic?
This Gaonim period. That's one take on what was going on then. And as to what, you know. And that's also a focus. I mean, you might say that during the Rishonim period, if we'll get to, there was such a focus on writing commentaries on the Talmud that it just built on itself, right? One great rabbi didn't, you know, at a certain point, now you weren't anything until you wrote a commentary on the Chumash or a commentary on the Talmud. That's when you were anything. Until that point, you know, it wasn't taken seriously. So, I don't know. It's hard to say exactly why. I'm sure there are historians who could give much better reasons than I'm giving now. So I'm not here to give the historical perspective as to why all these things happen, but end of the day, this is really, that's what this period is. It's almost defined as much as by what doesn't come out of that time period than what does. But like I said, so there could have been a lot that was written that we just never saw. I mean, you know, we're talking about time, everything's handwritten, all the books are handwritten, Jews are spread out, we could have easily lost things along the way and not even know about it. And there are Rishonim, even later generations, that we know we've lost books from that generation. There are many things that are quoted by others that we have no access to, we've never even seen before. That's just kind of the reality of what happens. Okay, let's get to the Rishonim, because this is going to be a major focus. The period of the Rishonim begins around 1000 CE. I'm going to erase this one because we'll get back to it, but I need a little more space here. Okay. The Rishonim are coming mostly from Europe. So this time period, now Jewish life has really moved out of Babylonia, mostly in Europe. There's still a large number of Jews living in the Middle East, but we don't have nearly as much writing from those areas. There are some of the Rishonim who move back to Israel, and then some to Egypt, like Maimonides does. So then we've got some more going on there. But you basically have three main streams. You have Spain, you have Ashkenaz, which is France and Germany. And you have Italy. Those are the three main places where your writings are coming from. The earliest Rishonim, though, are coming from Ashkenaz. The first leading rabbi of this time period is a rabbi by the name of, they called him Rabbeinu Gershon. His full name was Rabbeinu Gershon Or HaGola. Or HaGola means the light of the diaspora. So that's how much they thought of him. He was the light of the diaspora. that? Rabbeinu. Rabbeinu means like our rabbi. So he is like the founder of Ashkenazi Jew. He is the first main prevalent figure. I kind of look at it like I do American Jewry, that the first 100 years or so Jews were living in America, you didn't really have a prominent rabbi, you didn't really have prominent scholars. All the major questions were going back to Europe because that was the center of Jewish life. And even though there began to be a lot of people in America, it wasn't the center. So therefore, it was kind of seen as, you know, second rate. It was the boondocks. It was, you know, we know people are out there, but they weren't taking that seriously. But by the 1920s, 1930s, 1940s, as a lot of the rabbis were moving in from Europe, then at a certain point, America became a huge focus in Torah life. So that's kind of what happens here. He's not the first one to show up, you know, in France and Germany. He didn't plant his flag there and say, I'm the first Jew that's ever here. But he's the first one of prominence. And from this point on, Europe becomes the center of Jewry until the Holocaust. Literally until the Holocaust.
How about the Inquisition?
The Inquisition kicked Jews out of Spain, but they didn't leave Europe. So they didn't leave Europe en masse. They still stayed in Europe.
They came after to Spain. What? I mean, to Mexico.
Yeah, but that didn't become the center of Jewish life.
No, they went to Ashkenaz.
Some went to Ashkenaz, some went to South America. They spread out.
Some to Greece.
Yeah, but they more became part of existing communities than anything else. Yeah. So you're right. I mean, look, the center of Jewish life kept fluctuating between these different areas. In the beginning, it was more this Ashkenaz area, and then it kind of went to Spain, and then it kind of went back here, right? It was a lot of fluctuation. Italy had its own, as I was saying before, its own constant community, and it was producing a lot of very prominent books. And like it was somewhat isolated from the other two, because these two form these two different tracks, right? Spain becomes Sephardi. Sephardi, and Ashkenaz is Ashkenazi Jewry. So these two streams begin to happen starting around here in the early part of that of the millennia, and then from that point they just kind of keep going like this because they establish their own customs, they establish their own traditions, their own way of doing things, and then over hundreds of years the differences become cemented into this is the way we do things, right? And Jews are very into, this is the way we do things, right? Why do we do it? This is the way we do things. So that becomes a big split, and that continues. And Italy is not part of this, right? They're separate. Jews were living there for a good 900 years before this was happening. So they couldn't care less about the Ashkenazi-Sephardi split. They had their own customs and their own way of doing things. So...
more Israeli, would you say?
What?
Italy was more Israeli.
Israeli?
I mean,
there's no Israeli until 1940s, you know.
Is that all lost?
What?
Is that stream sort of lost, or those customs
Italy?
Kind of gone?
I'm afraid it's getting lost. It's very sad. So, you know, a couple Shabbos ago, I was talking to Daniel Rubin. He grew up in Milan, and... you know, we're talking about it. I mean, there's still people who hold it up. It's a very high intermarriage rate in Italy. A lot of the Jews that are there now are not from there. They moved from Russia and some Israelis and from... they have a whole Persian community there now. It's kind of losing its... It wasn't as big as these two streams. And when these two groups moved to other areas, they really retained their cultures and their traditions. Italy was just not as big... and, you know, again, there's some communities. I mean, I was in Venice in 2002, and I spent Shabbat there. And there's like four beautiful, stunning shuls that were built, I think, from the 1300s to the 1500s. And they're still intact, and they're just unique and different and just stunning. And there's four of them, and they daven in one of them for 3 months, and then they alternate because they can't... They can't fill two of them.
Oh, wow.
You know, so that's kind of the state of the community. And Venice in general is not an easy place to live. It's not, it's a very, you know, it's not a very modernized city. Just, it's limited in how they can modernize a city that old and built that uniquely. So, you know.
It's like a stage.
What?
It's like a stage.
What do you mean a stage?
You go to a theater and you see
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it's a hard place to live. It's a great place to visit. It's a hard place to live.
Yeah. But is there any difference between the Italian Jewry and Ashkenazi Spain? Then, any difference between them?
And traditions, like, and culture. Traditions, yeah, and culture. Customs, traditions,
you know,
and
like
culture.
I asked you said before, that the Ashkenazis can have only one wife. The Swardi can have more than one. How about the Italians?
Did they have more than one wife? I don't think they did. I think they took on that custom. So that goes back to Rabbeinu Gershom. So Rabbeinu Gershom, what he begins to do is he knows a series of decrees that were in place to modernize Jewish life. Let's put it that way. And as Jews were now living in this different culture, they had to do certain things to fit into the culture. So there's a lot of debate as to why he made these decrees. Partly it could be because that's the way the world was around them. So for example, having multiple wives, that was not what was happening in the world around them. They were afraid that Jews would look backwards if they were doing it. So that's one of the reasons given as to why they stopped doing it. Some other reasons given as well. Jews who lived in Europe, they're doing a lot of traveling for business. There's a lot of trade, so they were going between Spain and Germany, and you know, they'd be there for months at a time, and then they'd come back. So part of the fear was that you'd have a wife in every port, and you know, it's not. You know, you can just check their Facebook profiles to see where what's going on, so they could literally have multiple families, these people, and have no idea that this was going on. So that's another reason given as to why they know these decrees specifically at this time period. Okay. You know, because now there's Jewish communities in these different parts of Europe, so you would go here and go there and travel a lot. So there are a few main decrees that he makes. The most prominent ones are the ban on polygamy, the requirement that that women expressly accept divorce, that divorce has to be, she has to willingly accept it and it has to be stated as such. The way the Torah describes it, it's something that is initiated by the husband and then accepted by the woman, just as marriage is, you know, how he initiates it and then she accepts the ring. So that's how the divorce process works. But he decreed that it had to be quid pro quo, right? That had to be for both of them. And a few other things that he begins to, you know, one of his decrees is that you're not allowed to open or read other people's mail. He had a series of different decrees. But what he was doing predominantly was modernizing Jewish life and adjusting it to the society. And that's how these different cultures and traditions develop, because you're living in a certain country and there's a culture and there's a language and you develop your way of life. And, Sephardi Jews and Ashkenazi Jews lived apart for so many centuries in very different locales that they just developed very different ways of doing things.
And different languages.
Different languages, something different language, different cultures, different. A lot of things are different. So that began to develop more and more. So within Ashkenaz, now you began to have some very prominent Jewish leaders. The next one on the list, and probably the most famous commentary of all time, is Rashi. Rashi is an acronym, Reishin Yud, for Rabbi Shimon Yitzchaki.
Actually, I heard it's maybe Shlomo
Yitzchaki. I'm sorry, what is it? Shlomo Yitzchaki. Sorry, Shlomo Yitzchaki. So, Rashi really revolutionizes Torah writing. And he begins to write a commentary on the Chumash, on really all of Tanakh, like we talked about last week, the prophets and the writings, Nevi'im and the Ketuvim. and the Talmud, which he almost finishes. It's very sad. He it's in Baba Basra, I believe, right? Or it's in, I think it's like first paragraph of Baba Basra, where there's just a little note, and it says, Rashi's commentary ends here because he died. So his grandson now continues. It's a very, it's amazing to see, just, you know, it brings the humanity into it. You're reading this commentary, it's not a person, it's a thing, but then to actually read, he didn't finish it because he died now, and his grandson's taking over. It's just, you know. He does a number of different things. Rashi begins to make everything easier to understand. He makes Chumash easier to understand. He takes pieces from the Midrash and adds them in to kind of flesh out pieces that are unclear, historical pieces that are missing, adds a lot of commentary about Jewish law when it comes to aspects of Jewish law in the Torah. His main purpose is to give the what you would call the pshat, the simple explanation. He doesn't get a lot into wordplay. He doesn't get a lot into mysticism. He stays out of that. He's just kind of trying to explain what's going on. And the Talmud, he does the same thing. In Talmud, predominantly, he's just trying to explain what's going on. It's a pretty short, you know, it's short little snippets. And I'll show you the Talmud here. I mean, he's predominantly doing little snippets, right? So, I feel better with the bold. Okay. So if you see, we'll pass this around. So Rashi is here on the inside of the page. You see a bold part, which is telling which part of the... Here's the Talmud. So here's the Talmud. The bold part will be the few words in the Talmud he's commenting on. A line or two, maybe four or five, and then move on to the next point. Right? So it's very quick. It's very terse. He's trying to get as much explanations you can to a very short amount of space. In the Chumash, Chumash sometimes it'll be a little short, sometimes his commentary will be a little bit longer, but he begins the trend of writing a commentary on the Chumash and commentary on the Talmud, which really becomes the focus of this time period, doing those two things. Some other types of writing develop as well, but those two things become the focus. And again, something we didn't really see coming out of the Gaonic period so much. Okay. So Rashi lives through the First Crusades. So he's living the end of the 11th century into the middle of the 12th century. And he's living in France. And so he writes very often, especially in the Talmud. He'll give French definitions for words in the Talmud that don't help us out that much. But, you know, he'll say, in France, this is what it means. I just forgot what I was going to say. Okay. Alright, so he does that about a number of different things. Okay. Any questions on Rashi before we move on? Okay, also, his script is different. That's also an important point. Rashi has his own script, which is kind of the script that they were using at the time. It's still Hebrew, but it's a different script, different way of writing. Just like really in modern times we have modern Hebrew script where an Aleph looks like this, and a Bet looks like that, and a Gimel, and a Dalet, and a Hey, and a Vav, and a Zion, right? So if we were writing a commentary today, there's a very good chance we write Hebrew like that, which probably 1,000 years ago someone would see that, and they would say, an Aleph doesn't look like that, right? An Aleph looks like that, right? A Bet doesn't look like that. A Bet looks like that. So, different scripts develop over time. So Rashi has his script, which you have to learn. It's not that hard to learn, but you have to just learn it in order to understand what in the world he is talking about, or you can't get anywhere in Rashi. So, it's a good thing to learn as a kid, and then it just stays with you. But he's not the only one who uses it. It becomes used very often after that as well. So it's just part of the idiosyncrasies of Rashi. After Rashi comes a collection of scholars, which are known as Tosafot are a collection of a number of different authors. Tosafot means like the collection, basically. The extra ones, the addition to. So Tosfot is very often responding to a comment made by Rashi, either agreeing or disagreeing, very often disagreeing. Also asking a lot of questions in the Talmud. Tosfot only in the Talmud. So Tosfot is asking a number of different questions about the Talmud, which are predominantly cross-referencing, right? They'll bring a passage from somewhere else in the Talmud, ask how those two work together, there seems to be a contradiction, and then try to give an answer. Tosfot is made up of rabbis from Ashkenaz, but also from Italy. And that's also what's interesting, is you began to see the Italian scholars being mixed in with the Ashkenazi scholars, a little bit from Spain, but again, there's not a whole lot in Spain going on yet. It's beginning. But this is more a generation or two after Rashi, and then goes on for about 100, 200 years. The Tosafot, or they're called the Tosafists, you know, in scholarly writing, the Tosafists. Two of the major Tosafists are Rashi's own grandsons, Rabbeinu Tam and the Rashbam. And those Rabbeinu Tam is probably one of the greatest, you know, most prevalent. Right? So, again, it's Rabbeinu Tam. Rashi famously only has daughters. So that happens sometimes, right?
Yeah,
three. Ophir knows what I'm talking about. What?
Three daughters.
And
did he have five, actually?
What?
Did he actually have five daughters?
I thought he had three.
Three.
Yeah. Okay, I missed
that. I think he had three. Mm-hmm. So he has daughters, so it's his grandsons that become the scholars in the family. But two of his grandsons become two of the most prevalent scholars of their time, and really their whole time period. And then there's a number of other people in that time period, again, a span of 150, 200 years, from, let's say, about 1150 to 1300, that basic time range, that make up the Tosafot, you know, time period. And those become the major Ashkenazi commentary on the Talmud after Rashi. Okay, in Spain, what's going on is there's a lot of commentaries on the Talmud, but they're predominantly individuals writing their own commentaries. So you have Ramban, Nachmanides. You have the Rashba. You have the Ritva. You have a number of others. There are some Ashkenazi commentaries that are separate. The Mordechai, there's a few others that are not, say, lumped into Tosafot, but that's Tosafot's the prevalent Ashkenazi commentary in the Talmud, and they're all kind of lumped together. We can't go through every single commentary. Yeah.
My question, Tom. When was the page actually finalized as we know it now? And I'm assuming that back then, Rashi and his grandsons also wrote individual works, and then finally, maybe 100 years later, it was added into the Talmud page as we see today?
Yes, yeah. Well, yeah, when Rashi was writing, he didn't know it would be added to the Talmud page.
Yeah.
That really happens with the printing press more than anything. In the printing press, they began to... The page of Talmud as we see it was an attempt to just get the printing to all work out. So Tosfot has far less commentaries, but are often much longer, right? So Tosfot will have, let's say, 3 to maybe 8 on a page, but they're usually, you know, some of them are a lot longer. Some of them are these massive, you know, commentaries that just go on for, you know, take up the majority of a page. So yeah, the pages we have was just trying to fit in, because you need to have Rashi and the words he comments out on the same page, and tell us when the words he comments. So they had to just figure out how to do it.
And so, around like the 1500, the authority back then decided that it could be Rashi and Rashbam, and like someone basically decided these are the most important writers.
Yeah, it definitely was Ashkenazi centric.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Although, I mean, in the back, you know, and maybe there's something to why this fardim in the back. But this far more in the back. But there are a lot of Sephardi commentaries in the back of the Talmud. The Rambam is there, the Ramban is there, and a few others.
Okay.
Right. So there's the Riff is there. So there's a few others that are in the back. I don't know exactly why. I don't know if there's a...
So you flip in between, like, when you say they're in the back.
Yeah, you have to flip.
Okay, see. Some of like a footnote that you kind of can go back.
It's like it's additional commentary in the back, and then there's other books that are not in the Talmud book that you get their own. There are sets of commentaries to understand them. So you have to have them with you. Yeah. That's why there's so many books in a Beit Midrash and Jewish study hall, because they need everything on everything. So
everybody's saying something.
Yeah. I mean,
so quite a few people wrote commentary for the whole Talmud. The whole Gemara. Yeah.
Oh yeah. Well, there's a
rabbi in Israel now who completed this monumental commentary. It took him 45 years.
Yeah. So he did like a basic commentary. It was like a translation/commentary.
He did before, like years ago, Steinsatz.
Right.
Commentary, which is really good, but now he translated to Hebrew, I believe, right? To modern Hebrew.
Right. So that's what we have that over there. Right, that's what that is. But that's like a more modern explanation than really a commentary per se. It's very different than what was going on in the Rishonim period.
Post-Rishonim period.
We'll get to the Achronim period. The Achronim don't write a lot of commentaries on the Talmud. Not so much. Much less than during the Rishonim. Wait a second. There's lost in train of thought. You're just asking...
About the
preview. The one difference is this. Most of the commentaries only deal with the tractates of the Talmud that are practical in their age. So the Talmud that deals with the Karbanot, the sacrifices in the times of the temple, most of the commentaries we've shown them literally just don't touch them. Don't deal with them, don't give explanations. Ignore them completely. Rashi doesn't, Tosfos doesn't, but a lot of the others, especially the Spanish commentaries, don't even get into them.
The Rambam does.
We're going to get to the Rambam. He's his own category. But a lot of the commentaries don't even get into it. Yeah.
What language that it was written?
Mostly in Hebrew. Almost exclusively in Hebrew.
But there is something Armenian. There was another writing, and they spoke differently.
Armenian. Aramaic. The Talmud's in Aramaic. Right, that's a good point. I should mention that the Talmud is in Aramaic. It's a mixture of Aramaic and Hebrew, and it becomes Torah writing, I would call it. It's its own language at a certain point. Because when the commentaries are writing, they're writing in Hebrew, but they're using a lot of Talmudic terms, which are either Aramaic or Hebrew or mixes of them. So it develops its own language to a certain extent that you just have to get used to. It just takes time, but you get used to it. But that's how it works. It's its own writing.
And they're using the same letters?
There was a uniformity to it, which was an advantage, that if they're all writing in the same language, using the same terminology, someone from Ashkenaz can pick up something written in Spain or Italy and understand it. Because they're all using the same context to write from. So that was a big advantage. That helped the dissemination of the knowledge much more. Because they weren't writing in their own languages, which helped a lot. Yeah, it's a good point. Thanks.
By the way, the Geonim, what language did they use?
Mostly Hebrew.
Okay, not Arabic.
I'm sure some of these were in Arabic, but not so much.
And when did Hebrew become modern Hebrew?
Like we have it today?
Well, I mean, Ben-Yuda? Is there a big difference between...
Not really, Ben-Yuda.
Okay.
Is there a major difference? I mean, this type of writing has its own style. There's biblical Hebrew, which has its own style, and then there's Talmudic writing and the commentaries on Talmud, which have its own style. Like I said, it's a mixture of Hebrew and Aramaic. A lot of modern Hebrew terms will be based on terms you'll see in the Talmud and in the commentaries, which really is the majority of Hebrew writing that we have from the Torah until the early part of the century. Because who else was writing anything in Hebrew? Right? It's a very small group of people that were speaking it living in Israel. The Hebrew that was written was predominantly this. This is what was being written. A commentary on Talmud, a commentary on the Chumash, or some other book connected to it. So that's what they had. That's really what modern Hebrew is really based on. Except the word like telephone and microwave and things like that.
Computer.
Televisia.
You'll be.
What? Full-time job. Full-time job.
Jet lag?
Yeah.
Jet lag, full-time job. Yes, lo full-time job. All right, don't get me started. Okay. What?
That's funny.
I'll tell you, my Tiferet, a five-year-old, she's coming back with a Hebrew accent when she speaks Hebrew now. It's like kind of, that's interesting. Yeah.
You mean the Sephardi accent or just the...
Like, it's like the Israeli, you know, way of pronouncing. Your kids have it too.
I know, it drives me up. I can't understand them. I can't understand them.
That's
at
what
all.
Happens. But yeah, when they learn Hebrew in school from Israeli teachers, they come out speaking, you know.
Like, there's no R anymore.
Yeah. I saw saying she has a real Hebrew accent.
I can't roll my tongue.
If you spend enough time there, you can come out talking like it. Okay. Now, besides these types of writing, and again, a lot of these commentaries also are commentaries at Chumash, and they all have their own style, which is very interesting. And that's why it makes learning Chumash so interesting, is the different styles and the different commentaries. Like we said, Rashi is kind of giving the explanation as to what's going on. The Ramban is more thematic. He's dealing with bigger themes. He deals with connecting different parts of history. He deals with mystical, you know, aspects. The Rashbam also writes kind of a certain, you know, more basic commentary. Also, interesting about Chumash is Chumash doesn't have precedence in quite the same way. You will have rabbis who post-date this period who will question what's going on in this time period, will offer different explanations, and no one seems to be bothered by that. So you can have all these Rishonim, you know, discuss the story in their way, but people in our time can have a different way of looking at it, and it's not seen as like heretical to do that.
Like the Vilna Gaon will have a Gaon opinion.
Well, the Vilna Gaon would do that on Halacha too. So the Vilna Gaon will get to it. That's his own category. So that's interesting as well. But they also all had their own, predominantly their Chumash commentaries as well. A few of them become more prevalent. Rashi and Ramban become probably the two most prevalent commentaries in Talmud.
So Halacha is Talmud?
Halacha is Jewish law.
Just in general.
So this is the flow of Jewish law, right? Jewish law is predominantly dealing with the oral tradition. So the oral tradition gets funneled through this lens, okay? So it's starting off in the Mishnah, into the Talmud, into the Gaonim / Rishonim. So what they're doing is trying to figure out Jewish law and explain the Talmud. So what a lot of the Rishonim are going to do is give, this is what I think the law is in this case, based on the way I read the Talmud. And very often they'll disagree. Rashi will have one thing, Tosfot will disagree. Ramban will have a different way of looking at it, and so on and so forth. So that's what's happened during this time period. They're ironing out a majority, you know, a very large amount of issues in Jewish law. That's really what's happening.
I wonder if all these rabbis could have got together and sit on a table, would they agree?
They don't agree, but it's not a bad thing. We're not bothered that they disagree. That's part of the beauty of it.
I mean, they had the same goal to write down the laws or interpret it. But how do these two, like Rambam and Rashi, would get together?
There's never animosity. There's nothing personal here. There's no animosity. They would just go back and forth as to how they understood the law, and that's just the way Jewish law worked. It's a legal
system. Rambam was born after Rashi.
Well, I'm asking.
Right. But he could never. Right. Now, look, there is a flow. Like you said, there is a flow in history. Rashi can't really respond to Tosfos questions because he's passed away. Right. So he's getting the questions, and he can't really respond. Mm-hmm. But Tosfos views their role as pointing out what they think are flaws in Rashi's logic.
That was Bert Kamima type.
Is this? How does this in history, as far as writing down law, is Jewish law one of the first bodies of law that are actually written?
Well, I mean, it goes back to
and have this sort of back and forth discussion and commentary, or
I think it's a much more advanced
back and forth than what's going on probably anywhere else. I mean, I guess Rome had its forum. So I don't know how sophisticated that was. What?
I was lost.
Well, the writings were lost. The back and forth were lost. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, this is retained exceptionally well.
Right, it's like preserved.
It's preserved exceptionally well. I mean, literally, we're going back. We opened up these books. I mean, we're going back 2,000 years.
But it's almost like a model, because, I mean, if you look at science, it really, this is very, I mean, it's very similar.
Right. You're building on it, but then you're expanding it. You're building on it, but you're expanding
it. Right, and then, you know, you publish a paper, and then there's a commentary or whatever, and people get together and discuss, and that's part of the process.
Right, yeah, exactly. And it's a very, it's an impersonal process.
Right.
You know,
right.
If it ever got personal, you were not going to be taken seriously. If you were, if you were throwing personal attacks into your commentary, you were not going to make it. You know, it wasn't happening. And so that just didn't happen. It just didn't happen. And it doesn't happen. I mean, we have all this writings. You don't see anything like that.
The original books are still preserved, or just the writings?
I don't know exactly how many originals there are out there.
But there are some?
I don't know. I'm not sure historically what's left. I don't know. I don't think we have any original Talmuds from
1600 years ago.
Yeah. I don't know how far back we go with
centuries before printing.
Oh, for sure. I mean, that's why we talked about this last week. That's why the Talmud has a lot of has some discrepancies in what the text actually is. That comes up from time to time. It's like we said, it's much more prevalent in the Jerusalem Talmud than in the Babylonian Talmud. But certainly, the Babylonian Talmud there's sometimes Rashi and Tosfot, their disagreement is simply based on two different versions of the text that they had. Or certainly Ashkenaz versus Spain, they could sometimes have different versions of the text, and their understanding of Jewish law is based on the text that they had. And there were slight discrepancies between them, and that made all the difference. And that happened from time to time also. So in that sense, it is an imperfect system. It's an imperfect system that is supposed to be imperfect, because once it becomes an oral tradition being passed down for thousands of years, you're going to have an imperfect system. But it's a human system. It's a system that allows for the people involved to really make to make decisions.
It's also highly perfect. There's a lot of perfection in it too.
I'm saying it's that in some sense is its perfection, is that it doesn't try to be perfect. Yeah. If that makes sense. Yeah. Okay. Okay, let's get talk about Rambam real quick. Rambam, Maimonides, Rabbi Moshe ben Maimon. So it's Maimonides is the English way of saying it. And Rambam again is it's Rabbi Moshe ben Maimon. Maimon was his father's. So then he gets the E's at the itties at the end. So it's Rabbi Moshe, the son of Maimon. So Rambam does a few things that are unique. In many ways, he's ahead of his time. He doesn't have the same kind of commentaries that the others do during his time period. He doesn't really have a commentary in the Talmud. He has a commentary on the Mishnah, but that's small potatoes as far as how much he writes compared to Rashi commenting on every single line in the Talmud, pretty much, you know, close to it. Rambam's just dealing with the Mishnah, which is not nearly as expansive. Doesn't have a commentary in the Talmud per se. Doesn't have a commentary in the Chumash per se. He does a few things. The major work that he has, besides the commentary in the Mishnah, is something called the Mishnah Torah, which literally means the second Torah, which some people took offense to, right? As in, you need two things in your library, the Chumash and this, and then you're set. Okay, so some people took offense. He explains in his introduction why he calls it the Mishnah Torah. He's not trying to say it's the second most important book in the history of the world. He's trying to say that he's trying to incorporate all aspects of the Torah into one book, which was unique. Because previously, if you wanted to learn Jewish law, what did you do? Well, you went through the entire Talmud and went through all the commentaries and then tried to piece it together.
Now that's enough. You can do that. Great. That's not a very easy thing to do. So what he tried to do was compile it and organize it in a way that made it much more user-friendly and accessible. Right? So now instead of look it up in the Talmud, you have to know where to find it. There's the laws of Shabbat, the laws of Kashrut, the laws of Tefillah, of Davening, the laws of Yom Kippur, the laws of theft, the laws of murder, right? And it's compiled in a way that's very easy to follow and very easy to find things. So it became, I mean, it's a monumental work because he basically had to take the entirety of the Talmud and then organize it in his own way.
He indexed the Talmud, I guess.
He indexes the Talmud, yeah, and organizes in a way that makes, you know, that he can put together.
What, so how big is this?
So it depends.
In the other room.
It's in the other room. We can take a field trip to the other room. Yeah. Depends how many volumes. I mean, you can buy it in a 2-volume set, you can buy it in a 10-volume set, you can buy it in 20 volumes. It just depends how many commentaries and how big the words are and everything like that. There are 14 different categories and then different subcategories within it. He invented a whole new way of structuring Jewish law. It's not really replicated by anybody else. It couldn't be. I mean, it was just such a unique work. And the, you know, the amount of detail, it doesn't just do broad brushes. It gets into every nuance of every aspect of Jewish law. It's phenomenal.
It's really complete, in other words?
It's as complete, you know, obviously there's things that you could add to it, but it's as complete as you can get, especially with what he was working with in his time period. It's literally a work beyond comprehension when you begin to really get into it. No one else attempted such a thing, no one else did such a thing, and it just changes everything.
He's not taking the commentary of... He's taking
it. Is in essence his commentary.
I see, the way that he's organized it.
Well, because he has to write what he thinks the law is, right?
Gotcha.
So okay. The law is the way he interprets the Talmud. So therefore, when he writes a certain topic, he's got to say what he thinks the law is on that.
It's his interpretation. Yeah, okay. Right.
So it's his interpretation. But instead of writing it as a running commentary with the Talmud, he's just taking his commentary, organizing it his way, and then you've got to figure out. Now, he doesn't... What's interesting is that he doesn't mention his sources. He doesn't say, the law is this, and I'm basing that on this passage in the Talmud, because I read it this way. He just says, this is the law, and then you have to backtrack and figure out how we got there. So now there's a lot of... So afterwards, there was commentaries and generations soon after him, who spent their time going through Maimonides, going through the Rambam, and then explaining how he got to the conclusions that he got to, and then those who disagree. Right? So that becomes a work in and of itself. So now when you read it, you can always get back to the part in the Talmud you're looking for, because the commentaries have done that work for you. He also does a list of 613 mitzvot. So he does one of those. Like I said, that was popular. He also does... He has a number of different things. I won't get to some of the smaller things that he does. He also does the Guide to the Perplexed. The Guide to the Perplexed was written for people of his era, the perplexed people. Right? It was a book more on philosophy, which is something we don't see from Rashi. The Ramban, Nachmanides, ties a lot of philosophy into his commentary on Chumash, but you don't see so much in most of the other writings. He has an entire book just on philosophy. Theology and philosophy, which is meant for... He felt it was needed, that there was nothing like that for people, and lay people needed something to answer their questions. So he writes that in Arabic. Now it's been translated to whatever language you'd want to find it in. But he writes that... So the rest are in Hebrew, but he writes that in Arabic, because it's for the layperson. He lives in...
Most of his work was in Arabic.
Well, the Mishnah Torah is not in Arabic.
Yeah, but it's more than a few things.
What else was written in Arabic?
Almost everything he wrote is in Arabic.
The 613 mitzvot in Arabic? No.
I don't know about that.
No, there's no...
But a few things were in Hebrew.
The other things, especially his letters, were in Arabic. A few other things were... But that was, you know, definitely in Arabic.
He's a physician, too.
I'm sorry?
He's a physician.
Well, he lives a fascinating life, and we could do a whole class on him. He grows up in Spain. He's, he's able to spend full time on his learning because his brother is a wealthy merchant, and his brother basically supports him. And then his brother dies at sea. So he becomes a doctor because he has to support himself. And it happens kind of later in life. He makes his way to Israel. A few of the Rishonim make their way to Israel, which is also very interesting. There's a very strong Zionistic component to many of them. They really wanted to return to Israel. So even though in Maimonides' time in Spain, it was a very safe, comfortable place to be, but they wanted to go back. So Ramban does that. Well, it was becoming worse. Yeah, it was becoming worse. That's true. And, that, and Ramban also, there's a lot of anti-Jewish descent. But this is way before the Inquisition, but still, you know, you're right. There were certain things going on. So he makes his way to Israel, and then he goes to Egypt to become a physician because he can't make it in Israel, and that's why he ends up in Egypt. Okay. We'll do a little bit more. Gosh, I thought we'd do all of it, but yeah. Also, I wouldn't have enough material in that word for overtime. The last person I want to talk about during this time period, and we'll stop here, is Rav Yosef Cairo. Who does not live in Cairo.
Is he Ashkenaz or...
No. He is Sfard.
He's Sfard.
He is Sfard. But he lives in Israel. He lives in Tzfat.
Yep.
Who's been to Tzfat? Been to Tzfat? Yeah. Okay. Tzfat is a fascinating place. If you've never been to Tzfat, you gotta go to Tzfat. He lived there during the Renaissance of Tzfat, right? The end of the 15th century... There's a massive renaissance going on in Tzfat, which is the northern part of Israel. And it's known for its renaissance in Jewish mysticism, right? And even today, when you're in Tzfat, it just feels different. I don't know how to describe it. It's just a funky, spiritual, mystical kind of place. And, you know, if you walk the streets on a Friday night, it's just an eerie, interesting feeling. And this was just a hotbed of Jewish thought. I mean, it's one of the most unique periods of Jewish history, what was going on in that time in Tzfat. The Arizal, who becomes the... He kind of rekindles Jewish mysticism back into the forefront, lived in this time. And Rabbi Yosef Cairo was probably... Him and the Rambam were the two most prevalent and prominent writers, probably in Jewish history. He writes a number of different things. What he writes in his lifetime is astounding. It's astounding. He writes the Shulchan Aruch. The Shulchan Aruch means the set table, which means he's laying it out for you. What is he laying out? He's laying out Jewish law.
Could that be it?
What? Yeah, I think we have one here. It's practical Jewish law, so again, he doesn't get into things like Karbanot, he doesn't get into things that deal with the laws of living in the land of Israel all that much. Some of it, but not as much as others might write. So what he's doing is he's compiling, based on the Rishonim, the major Rishonim, he's kind of trying to take the consensus and formulating this is Jewish law, because during the Rishonim period, everyone was giving their law. This one, that one, this one, that one. He takes three major Rishonim. The Rambam is one. So it's Rambam. Someone, it was the Rush and the Rif. Those are three prominent rabbis. Spanish, Sephardi, and then he takes the majority of those three. That's usually what he does. It's a little more complex than that, but really that's pretty kind of what it comes down to.
Rush was asking.
The Rush was...
I think
it
was only Ashkenaz.
Was he Ashkenaz?
Yeah.
Okay, I don't remember. So, he takes two out of three. But what he's trying to do is just put a final cement... he ends up putting a final, you know, lock and key on this time period. This is the end of the Rishonim time period. He's summarizing what's gone on and saying, this is the law. He has a whole unique system again, of compiling and organizing. He didn't create it. It was based on a rabbi from previous generations known as the Tur. The Tur wrote a book called the Arba Turim, the Four Pillars, where he creates this setup, which I'm not going to get to all of it now. It'll take a long time. But it's a new way of organizing Jewish law. So it's kind of copying the Rambam's concept, but does it in a very different way. The first thing Rabbi Yosef Karo does is a very lengthy commentary on the Tur called the Beit Yosef, which is a very, it's an incredible work in and of itself. If that's all he did, he would still be one of the most prominent Jewish, halachic writers in history, but then he keeps going. And he writes a commentary on the Rambam, because why not? So he writes one of the most prevalent commentaries on the Rambam, and then he writes the Shulchan Aruch, where he ends up cementing Jewish law. I don't know how one person in their lifetime could do all three things. Each work could be a lifelong work. He does three. See, somehow fits in three lifetime works in one lifetime. It's unbelievable. And he's handwriting this. It's unbelievable. That's Svat for you. I don't know how to describe it. That ends up cementing the time period. Now, with Yosef Karo, he's writing from a Sephardi perspective. There is, simultaneously, someone doing something similar. He's kind of compiling the Ashkenazi Jewish law. He's known as the Rama, which is an acronym for Rabbi Moshe Isserles, from the Polish Isserleses. Isserles. So he's writing in Poland. He's writing the Ashkenazi version. We now, what they ends up having is they combine the two, it's now in one work. So now when you read the Shulchan Aruch, and I'll show you here, it's a sample. You have the bold is Rabbi Yosef Karo, and you have the smaller italicized is the Ramah. And so basically he's going to tell you when Ashkenazi tradition or custom differs with what he's writing. And within one book, you can get the Sephardic and Ashkenazi perspectives all in one shot.
By the same kind of topics in the Talmud, or is it a different way of organizing?
Very different. Like I said, he based it on the way the Tur organized it, okay, which is four head categories and then a number of subcategories within that. I'll just tell you real quickly. The first one is called Orech Chaim. Orech Chaim deals with daily Jewish life, mm-hmm, and holidays. So it's blessings and davening and Shabbat and holidays, tefillin, tzitzit, things that we do every day. One is called Evan Ha'ezer, which is marriage and divorce. Sorry. Press 845. Area code.
That's Muncie.
Muncie. Yeah. I got two calls in 5 minutes from Muncie.
Yeah, that's a long way away.
No, I know Muncie. I know people in Muncie.
Is it like midnight
there? It's 11. Marriage and divorce.
Marriage and divorce.
So we're talking about marriage and divorce. You get a call from Muncie?
Oh, yeah.
At 12 o'clock in the night.
Is someone getting married or divorced in Muncie? Yeah. Then, okay, so Orech Chaim, Evana Ezer, Choshen Mishpat, which is civil law, theft, your ox scores, my ox, real estate law, all
internet,
all that kind of fun stuff. What am I forgetting here? Oh, Yoredeya. Is all the stuff that doesn't fit into the other categories. So your day is the mishmash.
Miscellaneous.
But a lot of the most important stuff is there. Laws of keeping kosher are there. Laws of mikvah are there. Laws of mezuzah and honoring your parents and giving tzedakah and mourning. It's the miscellaneous, but it's a lot of very important stuff. It just doesn't really fit into any of these categories. So these are the categories that the Tur develops. And then the Tur writes his kind of book of Jewish law
using this, and then the Yosef Karo takes that and then makes his own book out of that structure. And then there's a lot of commentaries that develop after that based on the Shulchan Aruch. So what you end up having is something called the Acharonim, right? The next time period is the Acharonim. Rishonim means the first ones. Acharonim means the last ones. So Acharonim are anyone after Rav Yosef Karo. So 1500s and on. Maybe a little bit into the 1500s and on.
Barbanel would be considered...
he's a Rishon. Yeah, he's a late Rishon. But he doesn't do...
He goes into the 1500s.
But he's doing mostly commentary on Chumash, so it doesn't really matter where he fits in as much. So that's what we have here. So that's the Achronim. The early Achronim are predominantly writing commentaries on the Shulchan Aruch. That's a lot of what they do. And then as it develops, we begin to get a lot of different types of writing. What you begin to see in modern times is not a new concept, but I'd say the biggest contribution of the past couple hundred years is responsa. Right? Responses to questions. Now, we have responsa going back into the Rishonim period. We have responsa from every major Rishon, pretty much. But in modern times, the responsa becomes the major method of Jewish law. That as new things are happening, and we want to know how to understand electricity on Shabbat, and medical procedures, and you name it, you know, is microwave cooking? I mean, you know, again, is it, you know,
the elevator?
The elevator is a car. Is a is a combustion engine? Is that what it's called in a car?
Yeah, combustion engine. Internal combustion.
Right. Is an internal combustion engine? Is that considered lighting a fire? I mean, you name it. Response to dealing with it.
Dishwasher timers.
For dishwasher, right? Yeah. I mean,
timers.
And that's only the technology side of things. Forgetting, just the changes in sociological elements. So the major Jewish law today are with responsa, and we have a lot of compilations that have been happening, especially lately. So it's like laws of kashrut, and it's going to be all the different perspectives on the different laws of kashrut, laws of Shabbat, and of course now we have the English books and stuff. But the responsa becomes a major avenue where the modern Torah scholars... Their opinion on Jewish law comes out.
When was that written?
Responsa? It's being written till today.
Oh, it's been written. Now, how can they justify it that in Mother Bern there was time when they went on a horse buggy and today they have car?
How they justify it?
Well, that you can't sit in a car.
What do you mean? Read the responses.
What?
Read them, they're there.
Okay.
It's not hidden from us.
You can go bicycle riding.
I can't get into specifics. Okay. I mean, that's right. Not, you know, okay. That's way beyond what the purpose here is.
Okay. Not even in the air?
Okay, we're not getting into specific laws. I'm happy to answer any questions afterwards. Well, not right now, but some other time. So there's a lot of responsa. Also, with the same basic concept that Achronim don't really challenge Rishonim. There is that same level of respect. You know, the Shulchan Aruch has a law. It's pretty much seen as final. Maybe some exceptions. You know, we talked about the Vilna Gaon. The Vilna Gaon was a fascinating figure who lived in the 18th century. He kind of breaks the rules on some things. He just... had his perspective, he was called the Gaon because he was a prodigy and genius, and was seen as like a once in a century scholar, and he was in that century probably the most prevalent figure. So he ends up doing a lot of his own things in halacha. He's a very unique figure who did that. I mean, we can't get into all the people that we've used, but so he does write a commentary. You know, on the Shulchan Aruch, and does a lot of other things as well. But again, the, most of the writing coming out during this time, there's commentaries in Chumash, a lot of writing, you know, you have commentaries on commentaries, right? The Maharal from Prague, you know, the famous Golem Maharal, right? It's a commentary on Rashi, because that starts to happen. So you have a commentary on the commentaries. They call them super commentaries in academic circles. So it's a number of different things. Are any questions right now before we wrap up? Okay. I'll take that as